Kirby Monsters is a podcast about facing the unknown.
I start to float away from the earth.
Have you ever smoked crack before?
We're all kind of frantically searching for meaning.
They have the neurotransmitters.
I think we're all juggalos in some way.
Yo, we're not broken.
Crazed delinquents.
We're in our last days, young man.
Listen to Here Be Monsters,
the podcast about the unknown,
on the KCRW iTunes page.
Funds for Bookworm are provided in part by Lannan Foundation.
From KCRW and KCRW.com, I'm Michael Silverblatt, and welcome to Bookworm. Today, my guest is Ryan Gaddis. His novel, All Involved, has just come out in paperback from Echo Press, and it's an important book. It's a book that was written, 23 years after the events that took place in Los Angeles in 1992. Ryan was not living in Los Angeles at the time. It's a reconstitution, in a way. He spoke to artists, to gang members, to nurses, to police, to people who were involved not just in the riots, but in those parts of the riots that were taking advantage of the mayhem that was occurring in the wake of the Rodney King decision. Pent-up anger got expended. It became the occasion for a lot of shooting and retribution within the gang communities. Can you tell me how you entered those communities to be able to write about them? You're not making a nice picture. This is a tough, violent, intense novel. Every chapter is narrated by a different one of 17 voices. We're put in their heart of hearts as much as you can.
I'm a survivor of violence. You know, when I was 17, standing at the back of a student council class, I was hit so hard in the face it tore my nose out. I had two facial reconstructive surgeries. I think my understanding of violence is very much one of deep physical consequence. And that's really what I try to put into my writing. I try to capture that. I try to make it clear to people that this is what violence is. This is what it feels like.
The reader who reads your first chapter is going to go right into shock. An innocent man walking home from his job on a taco truck. He's been working at a birthday party. He has a brother who's trouble. His brother really goes gangbusters whenever his temper is piqued. You don't know where it's going to stop. And so people are retaliating against a man named Ernesto. He's older. He has a job. He's respectable, responsible, gentle. He's helped people in the community escape from La Vida Loca. And this guy is not just stabbed. He's hit with a baseball bat. He loses an ear. You know, his eyes are blinded. He's tied with wire and pulled down the street. I mean, what's left is not a body. It is a corpse in every way. And he's left to be found by his relatives, who will go immediately into action to retaliate. I can't think of an opening chapter as likely to daze and shock a reader.
I was terrified of starting it the way I did. But once I'd started writing, I knew that had to be how it opened. I use present tense for a reason, so that we're never quite sure who's going to make it, who's going to be okay. I think it dramatically upped the danger level, even though I've never really written in present tense before. I think that was really, that felt risky to me. And given the subject matter, given the time, it was an incredibly dangerous time. And insofar as I could tell, the 6 days where there's essentially a justice vacuum that opens up all over South Central Los Angeles, you know, that needs to get filled somehow. And unfortunately, what happens is some of the gangs at that time, you know, saw it as an opportunity really for it to become the Wild West. My initial conceptions of the novel were that it was Western noir, that for 6 days, you know, justice was going to come at the hands of whoever wanted to deliver it. And so in order for something like that to feel like it has sufficient weight, the stakes have to start high. And in this case, you know, the murder of an innocent man, that there didn't seem any other way to do it.
He seems, pardon me, Ryan, to be murdered 4 or 5 times in the course of that chapter. What we're hearing from are people who do not have a sense of when enough is enough. They're not leaving him dead, they're leaving him dead and mutilated and destroyed.
You know, as most Los Angeles law enforcement might refer to it, it's certainly an overkill situation. You know, that's the euphemism for it. Unfortunately, it is what happens, you know, when the state is ineffective, you know, in instituting justice, and it's up to these gangs to kind of get their own back. And it was born out of this intense frustration and rivalry between two of the gangs in the book when they weren't able to get back for, you know, a death of another character that happens off page. And because the character who did that, Lil Mosco, whom you referred to earlier, the very wild brother who will just fly off the handle, he's been protected to a certain extent. He's been hidden. He's been sent on, you know, different runs and routes so that he can stay safe. But unfortunately, in that type of situation, the justice then, well, justice insofar as this other gang perceives it, just simply found someone close to him instead. And it was this unique opportunity to show that, look, as bad as things were in the late 80s, early 90s in Los Angeles, certainly in that gang world, these 6 days of the riots were really when there were no rules.
This book is taking us out into the streets where we're told not to go. You know, there is in this writing a sense of violation. Throughout the city, people were being asked not to look, not to see, not to know.
Lock your doors. Stay inside.
Lock your doors, exactly. Watch it on TV.
Yeah. Well, I think the unique possibility within fiction and within the novel specifically as a form gives us that opportunity to be there, to be along for the ride, not just along for the ride, but in the minds and hearts and souls of these folks. And in a number of these characters, I mean, they're not all gang members, but with a number of them, they, you know, what they say in dialogue is so frequently different from what they're thinking, what they're feeling, what they're going through. And only a novel can bring that to a reader. And I think for me, you know, being an outsider, being someone who comes from Colorado Springs, from a military family, you know, I was 13 years old. I remember watching, you know, that sequence of what happened to the truck driver, Reginald Denny, in Florence and Normandy. I remember watching that on the nightly news and just being terrified because I thought I had just seen a man die on national television. You know, it was, this book has to feel risky. It has to feel like there are elements of, oh wow, you know, how true is this? Because that's, I think, when fiction is truly transcendent, when it can really push us to ask questions and perhaps most importantly, really make us wonder, what is life like for folks over there? I think literature is absolutely an empathy engine. It gives us that window to deeply connect with others through story.
The novel we're talking about is all involved, by my guest, Ryan Gaddis. Now, this is an expression all involved. What does it mean?
It means someone is a gang member. It means they're in the gang life. You know, if it's almost a shorthand euphemism of sorts. You know, if you were walking down the street, you see someone lurking, you turn to someone else and you say, hey, you know, what's going on with that guy? And the person tells you, oh, he's all involved, which means so many things more than that. But something really fascinating happened while I was, you know, talking to people about the book, which was I learned about firefighter jargon. And when a building is on fire, it's referred to as involved. So that was not something that I initially thought of, but I saw that instant connection with the word. And so it was amazing is that it completely applies to the city, the conflagration, 11,000 fires in Los Angeles during that 6-day period, which is almost unimaginable.
Well, as the book continues, it becomes a work made out of, I would say, pure breath and stamina. A level of poetry enters. I know that when you studied at East Anglia, you worked with the poet laureate Andrew Motion. Do you feel that kind of propulsive poetry runs the book?
Wow, that's a great question. I've never been asked that before. Yes and no. I think one of the wonderful things I found, you know, being supervised by Andrew was that he was very much driven by the idea of the mot juste, you know, the exact right word for the exact right moment. What I eventually learned to do many years later was apply that in my own way, mainly having just listened to lingo, to argo, and it doesn't matter if that's, you know, firefighters or former gang members, you know, that it seemed to me that there is a poetry in daily speech, you know, that is just as good and just as clean, even if it's not always intentional or purposeful, but it's no less beautiful.
Now, we get to a point toward the end of the novel where things are dying down. Order is being restored. But by now, even members of the bourgeoisie, people who have property, become aware that this may be the time to burn it for the insurance. And we go with a young boy and his father, and what we're going to hear now is a conclusion where the beat of the violence of the city as it dies down becomes pure heartbeat. What we're hearing is the sound of a city clarifying itself and becoming whatever it will be next. This is Ryan Gaddis reading from the end of his novel, All Involved.
In L.A., it only means that things are different from the last time you could go out at night. And from now on, when we talk about these days, we'll talk about what they did to us, we'll talk about what we lost, and a wedge will get driven into the history of the city. On either side of it, there will be everything before and everything after, because when you've seen enough bad things, it either breaks you for the world or it makes you into something else. Maybe something you can't know or understand right away, but it might just be a new you, like when a seed gets planted yet to be grown. Kerwin turns up the music, and the chorus hits as the boulevard spools out beneath me with its yellow dotted line racing alongside before falling away into asphalt blackness. A warehouse next to the nearest burned apartment complex quickly blocks most of the Victorian from my view, and all I can see is the library window flickering orange like a winking jack-o'-lantern eye before we get too far down the road, and that light is gone too. All that's left to see of the house then is where it's going. Skyward, as a black tower forms above it. I'm hoping to see it better the farther away we get to understand more. Because maybe if I see the rest of the neighborhood and how it burned, if I see how other people were targeted and suffered too, I can understand. But right now, all I can focus on is our house and how it hurts to see it go and how the distance doesn't give me any perspective, so I close my eyes. I put both my hands palm down on either wall of the truck's bed and hold tight to metal and chip paint as the rhythm of the street bumps me forward and back. Through the window behind me, I hear the song winding down. I hear it running into the wind, tangling with the whooshing sound of it, and I picture how things used to be. I see how the Victorian looked when I was 14, faintly blue in early morning light. I see underripe avocados in the grass, hard and green, the kind I used to pick and play soccer with, and beyond the tree that dropped them, I see one of the apartment blocks stand tall like a sentry, its roof only just going orange in the dawn. Something turns heavy in my chest when I imagine my own neighborhood, the one I grew up in, intact again. I see Ham Park's wooden handball wall still up, kids playing on it, and grown men too, and the thumping sounds of their Saturday games echoed for blocks. And as far away as Momo's house, it just sounded like a heart beating. And maybe it was even the city's heart beating too fast. In my head right now, Momo's house is whole again. His car's parked out front and he's walking to it with keys in his hand, nodding a hello at me as I go by on my chopper, and that's when it hits me. My memories are the only places I'll ever see any of it again. And I wonder if this is what writers are supposed to do, rebuild places in their minds, places long gone, places that disappear, and I wonder if that's true. Is it true of people who disappear too? A song's fading out now. I hear the girls' voices melt into the bass line as what's left of their harmony gives itself up to the wind and the grumble of the truck's engine. For two good breaths, I don't hear anything but sirens far away. I don't hear anything but the truck worrying its axles. When a new song begins, a different kind, one with a loud drum beat, I don't recognize it, and it's a small thought that hits me then, but I feel it rumble and grow with each building whipping past, with each block. I feel myself agreeing with it. LA has an engine too, and it won't stop. It can't. It's a survivor. It will keep going no matter what, and it will push right through these flames and come out the other side of them as something broken and pretty and new.
You just heard Ryan Gaddis reading from the end of his novel, All Involved. I'm Michael Silverblatt. You're listening to Bookworm from the studios of KCRW. We're talking with Ryan Gaddis about his book, All Involved. We'll continue after this short break.
Immerse yourself in Rhythm Planet, hosted by Tom Schnabel, the world music blog and podcast dedicated to history, storytelling, and, of course, the music. Check it out now at kcrw.com/rhythmplanet.
I'm Michael Silverblatt. This is Bookworm, and I'm talking with Ryan Gaddis about his book, All Involved, a captivating, thorough account of the peripheral violence during the violence of the 1992 six-day LA riots. Now, that section, who is the speaker? Who is the person talking there, Mikey? Tell us about him.
He's a young man who grew up in relatively similar circumstances to the gang members in the book, but he has a very different take on life, and he certainly has some more opportunities by virtue of the fact of how hard his father has worked and you know, a business empire of sorts that he has built. Mikey so desperately wants to be a writer. He just doesn't exactly know how to go about that yet or what's worthy, you know, for him to write. But he's also very much, you know, I think it's safe to say, you know, he's a bit of a mod. You know, he loves ska, and you know, he rides a Vespa around, and he's this kind of odd kid from this area that no one really knows what to do with, and he ends up having this very eclectic group of friends. But I mean, he was one of my favorite characters to write. I think very effectively demonstrates, you know, some of the diversity that goes on there. I think sometimes we, you know, we're presented with visions of South Central through whether through music or films, and it's very one-dimensional, I think. But Mikey is one of those who I think is very much true to the era, but deviates from it in a really beautiful way.
Well, the book is full of characters like Mikey or like Termite. He finds an unmarked bus in an alley where buses are held when they're not being used.
Yep.
Where there isn't a driver.
Yeah, it's called a layup. So it's a bus parked in a layup spot on Norton.
And he has his spray paints, his special paints, and he can't believe it. He's going to have the opportunity not only to do the whole bus. This is his painting, and this is his form of art, and this is his form of writing. And the bus becomes a memorial, finally, to the first man we saw murdered. His name, Ernie, is on the back of the bus. As the bus travels around, people see where it says Ernie, R.I.P. Who's Ernie? How did he die? Well, this is a way of telling the story, or at least asking the question, what was the story? Everyone here wants to make sure that although the mayhem is over, that the story can still be told, that we don't go back into a Los Angeles that doesn't know what happened to it.
I think that's, I mean, that's very astute, and that's absolutely a big chunk of what I was going for, that somehow this storytelling in whatever sense, in whatever way, will persist. You know, the section that I read earlier, you know, that refers to it as well. You know, in order for us to understand how Los Angeles has changed, we can't forget what has made it change in the first place. And I think if there's any legacy to be taken from the riots, it's that we are far better about communicating now than we were then. I think there was a certain balkanization of Los Angeles. You know, you had very insular immigrant communities who wouldn't necessarily speak to one another. And yet afterward, you know, I think that we're in a pretty great place now. And a lot of it has to do with, you know, intercultural sharing and a deeper understanding of the power and the diversity of the city.
During the writing process itself, I'm not sure I'll ever quite understand why, but you decided to have a back piece. That is to say, your back is tattooed from the back of your neck to your upper thigh with sleeves on both arms.
The sleeves were done this year, but yes, the back piece.
And this was while you were writing.
Yes.
So that you couldn't sit for more than 20 minutes at a time.
Yep.
And the writing, which is about pain, you did while in pain. So you were bringing your own pain to the pain of the novel.
I think the reason why we were in this amazing rush is because my artist, my tattoo artist, Mr. Chris Brand, you know, had this amazing opportunity to do a museum show that was actually highlighting his back pieces, highlighting him as a genuine leader and master in neo-Japanese tattooing. So we had a deadline of sorts. And so it was incumbent upon me to really be disciplined about going in there and sitting. The fact that it just happened to coincide with the book, I think it's very difficult to refer to that level of pain as a happy coincidence, but I do think it helped me elevate and connect with, you know, the pain of the characters in the book that much more.
Now tell me, this book, All Involved, comes after several, are they young adult novels? Are they, they've got funny names, Kung Fu High School,
sure.
Roo Kick Kick, and The Big Bad Blimp. Was this your breakthrough, and how does it feel now? Did writing this book free you or imprison you?
Oh, that's a wonderful question. I think, you know, when I wrote Roo Kick Kick, which hasn't been released in this country, it was released in the UK, and when I wrote Kung Fu High School, I was 22, 23 years old. You know, I've grown up a lot since then, you know, and a lot of that growing up was writing a really terrible book for about 8 years, a very long novel that I hated, you know, doing at the time. But now I feel like in a way that was my postgraduate work. You know, it taught me how not to write a long novel.
That came before work on All Involved.
Yes, it sure did. It sure
did.
Was
set in China?
It was set in Japan.
Japan.
Yeah. I thought my career was over, actually. And in fact, I had quit. I thought for certain there was no way, you know, I'd get another opportunity, you know, having not sold a book in 8 years, 9 years. So I moved to downtown Los Angeles, and I became a member of UGLAR, the Unified Group of LA Residents, and I basically just did an internship, you know, on the streets of LA with them. I carried paint, you know. My job was, you know, to be someone who ran interference, which meant that in any of these neighborhoods, when we were painting legally for the city, people will just walk up, and it was my job to talk to them because the artists are on a deadline.
Wow. Uh-huh.
So it, you know, so I owe them this great debt, because when I thought my career was over, completely done, I started learning, in fact, that my impulse to write is very much triggered by listening, by this, you know, aural understanding of the world, and being able to hear these different voices, these different thoughts, these different worldviews. You know, that was incredibly exciting to me. And you know, you asked earlier, did it free me or imprison me? I think it absolutely freed me, because up to that point, I had a relatively traditional creative writing education. You know, I'd gone to Chapman University and done a BFA, and I did, you know, work on my MA in England. In both of these places, I was always told, you know, read lots of books and then lock yourself in a room and write. And that actually was very unhealthy for me. I did that, and I wrote a terrible book. But it was when I had walked out the door, and when I was placing myself in situations where I didn't necessarily feel safe, I was learning more about myself and more about other people than I ever had in my entire life. And I think, you know, I'd like to believe that knowledge, that understanding, that respect and appreciation really filtered its way into the fiction.
I've been talking with Ryan Gaddis, author of All Involved, published by Echo, just out in paperback. Thank you, Ryan, for joining me.
Thank you, Michael. My pleasure.
You can comment on today's show or read an excerpt from All Involved at kcrw.com/bookworm. Download the podcast from kcrw.com or from iTunes. You can also listen on demand with KCRW's smartphone apps. My co-producer is Connie Alvarez. Alan Howard is associate producer. The technical director is Mario Diaz. Special thanks to my assistant, David Sobel. I'm Michael Silverblatt. Join me again next week on Bookworm.
I am a bookworm, he is a bookworm, she is a bookworm, we are all bookworms. I am a bookworm, we are all bookworms.
Funds for Bookworm are provided in part by Lannan Foundation. This program is produced in the studios of KCRW Santa Monica. You can access archives of all Bookworm programs and podcasts, the most recent ones, at kcrw.com/bookworm. The Bookworm themes were composed and performed by Ron and Russell Mayle of Sparks.
I'm Michael Silverblatt. Join me again next time on Bookworm when Daryl Pinkney is our guest.
I want to tell you about a new show from the Financial Times called Life and Art from FT Weekend, hosted by me, Lila Raptopoulos. Life and Art is twice a week. On Mondays, I have a guest on to talk about life and how to live a good one. Everything from winter travel to cooking to living more creatively. And on Fridays, we talk art. Two FT journalists and I discuss a piece of culture that's in the air. New music, movies, and more. Find Life and Art from FT Weekend wherever you listen.